Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimaginedonline.org, covering the stories in the new world of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, the architect of Florida's modern education system of parental choice. The two celebrate 20 years of the existence of Step Up for Students by looking back at the original implementation of Governor Bush's education agenda and look forward by discussing the implementation of what both men believe to be the future of education choice, ESAs, Education Savings Accounts. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
So I'm thrilled to have former Governor Jeb Bush with us today. We're celebrating the 20-year anniversary of Step Up for Students. For our listeners, Step Up is a nonprofit that runs some of the scholarship programs in Florida. There are actually 22 tax credit programs in the United States. Step Up is larger than the other 21 combined by about $100 million. So it's a very, very large nonprofit, has a big footprint in the education choice space. And one of the reasons that we exist is because of former Governor Jeb Bush. So we're excited to have Governor with us to talk about the future, but also a little bit of celebrating where we are today with Ed Choice in Florida. So welcome, Governor.
Thank you, Doug. I would say that the reason why we have parental choice to the extent we do is because of the consistent, high integrity, professional implementation of these programs, which, as you know, since you were working on it day to day, is not easy to do, but Step Up has played such a critical role. One big mistake early on, and all the critics would have said, see, I told you so.
Yeah.
And so kudos to Step Up for 20 years of incredible service on behalf of literally hundreds of thousands of families who otherwise wouldn't have choices.
Thank you, Governor. We actually just served our 1 millionth family last year. So
amazing.
We're working on our second million now. So I just want to do a little bit of history and context, and then we'll quickly move to to where we are today and into the future. When you ran in 94, you ran on a very visionary platform. You ran on an idea of sort of universal education choice. And I'm curious if that's still the goal. Is the vision, from your perspective, you know, every child having access to a full continuum of education choices, either in a school district or outside of a school district?
Yes, it is. Now they're called education savings accounts. In 1994, I guess they were called vouchers, and it was a radical idea. I didn't put enough context around why, you know, what the moral imperative was, why everybody should have choices, why that's not a radical idea. I mean, every aspect of our lives, we have an abundance of choices. And in education at that time, and even today, a lot of parents are told where their kid will go to school. Thankfully, Florida has broken that that dam, if you will. And what now, Doug? Maybe half of children, parents choose where their kids go to a school, a public school, a magnet school, a charter school, a private school, a not for, you know, non-religious school. I mean, it's incredible, virtual school. So we are offering an array of choices today, but back then there were very few.
So you passed your very famous now A-plus plan in 1999 that actually predated the tax credit program by about two years. That program was a combination of choice and working in the district schools where you didn't really have choice. So you had to figure out how to use the regulatory tools you had available to you. Talk about how you tried to think that through, how you tried to manage the fact that universal choice probably wasn't politically feasible in 99. So you had to figure out how to navigate the environment you're in. I'm just curious how you thought about that and how you navigated that balance between choice and regulation.
It kind of started in 96, really, in 97 and 98, in the wilderness between campaigns. I decided maybe a year and a half before the 98 campaign, I wanted to run again. I had built one of the first one of four of the first charter schools in the state with T. Willard Fair, the Urban League. I saw firsthand how hard it was. I saw how districts kind of did the Heisman on anything we wanted to do. It was really tough. Back then, now charter schools are much more accepted. So I learned a lot, and I put a human context around. I went to visit 250 schools as a candidate in 98, and I laid out the A-plus plan in advance as a candidate. I wish we could get back to that, where political figures, candidates for office, would say what they want to do, because it actually gives them a chance to do what they said they were going to do. And so I had that chance. Whether I had a mandate to do what I ended up implementing or not is really not relevant. I claimed it, you know.
Yeah.
The legislature went along, and we did implement the A-plus plan, which was two pillars of which were more choices and robust accountability. And if schools were failing, parents would be given other options. And we accelerated that so that the first opportunity scholarships were awarded in 99 for four different places in the state. And then when that was ruled unconstitutional three or four years later, Step Up really filled that void. I'll never forget going to the graduation ceremony of meeting the first graduates from the opportunity scholarship moments, because like 10 years later, and these were all grown up, you know, young men and women that were going to college. Some of them lost their voucher and got a Step Up scholarship.
Right.
But Step Up, it wouldn't have happened. And so, again, right. Step Up has played such a constructive role, created a catalyst for much bolder, bigger voucher and corporate tax scholarship programs, more expanded public school choice. I'm not sure that was necessarily the only catalyst, because the whole objective was to continue to build on this small voucher program in 1999. But it did help. It did help kind of create a catalyst. And thank God for successive governors. Even old Charlie Crist, you know, was a big supporter of these programs back then. And the Florida legislature, leader after leader, has been spectacular in my mind. I mean, I don't think there's a state in the country that has been consistently pushing the ball up the hill and expanding whenever possible options for parents.
You mentioned earlier that about half the kids in Florida now are attending a school other than their zone neighborhood school. So clearly, I think we're past the tipping point, and we're not going back, obviously. But it also raises, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of very interesting technical issues, which is what keeps me up at night, trying to figure out, you know, how to build a new infrastructure for basically a whole new public education system. So I wanted to pick your brain a little bit, help me out with some of the things I'm struggling with. one of the things I think a lot about is accountability in a world where kids are using educational savings accounts. I think both you and I would agree that's probably where we're going. And for our listeners who don't know about ESAs, that allows them to spend money on a variety of things beyond just schools. And so whether it's tutors, summer programs for our special needs, unique abilities kids, it's physical therapy, occupational therapy. Kids take virtual schools. And we're increasingly seeing kids attending multiple institutions at the same time.
Right.
So I'm curious about, I mean, your A-plus plan was built on the assumption basically that kids are attending a particular school, you know, continuously, whereas we're increasingly seeing kids in all kinds of different environments, Governor, at the same time. And so I'm struggling with the whole accountability concept, because it doesn't, if a child's in three different schools, for example, a virtual school, a dual enrollment program, and perhaps, you know, a couple classes in a neighborhood school, how do you think about accountability in a world that's much more diverse, as opposed to the old industrial model where, you know, you go to one school, that's where you go, you know, you hold that school accountable. Now I've got kids all over the place. What advice would you give us about how to think about accountability in that context?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real, we're transitioning in the future looks very different than where we are today, and where we are today is dramatically different than 20 years ago, for sure. So these transitions are not easy. I would start with fiscal accountability.
Okay.
That still is like, and this is where Step Up plays a really important role. the critics of choice, and they're still out there. I mean, there are people that actually want to go back to the old way. It's like, what are you thinking? I mean, all schools are better. Public school, traditional public schools are better because of parents being having these choices. And a more dynamic system yields a better result. Now, we can always do better, but we're far better off today than we were 20 years ago. So fiscal accountability is the first step. It's harder to do the accountability that we set up 20 years ago, for sure. I mean, ultimately, you want to move to a system where you're measuring progress, where you master the material, you move on to the next, irrespective. I mean, you could be taking math virtually, or you could take it, you know, take a course in the community college, take the rest of your courses because you love to play football. There's lots of reasons why you would have a variety of choices. So I think first is fiscal accountability. Second is total transparency of the options and give parents more than just here are the choices. Here are the choices with these with these results.
Right.
Here are the benefits. In other words, if a quarter of all kids can take college level courses and as juniors in high school, at least that's the study that about 3 or 4 years ago came out suggests that, then parents ought to be given the options to allow them to do that, because that's going to save a lot of money. It accelerates learning, and you should be able to graduate early if you've graduated as a freshman. You should not have to wait till you can graduate from high school. I mean, that's all still work in progress, but part of the reason, an important element of this is total transparency and, you know, accountability can also be embedded in the data that parents receive. And ultimately, they're the ones that should be making these choices. The notion that somehow some bureaucrat from up above, either in Tallahassee or in a school district, one of our big school districts, knows better what the unique needs of a student is more than a parent, I just reject out of hand.
Right.
So then finally, we have to have a testing system that actually can measure this. And that becomes more complicated because you don't want to impose the public school accountability system on private schools. But you also want to make sure the private schools are held accountable, too. So, you know, I can see why you're waking up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, because this is not easy stuff. And state policymakers are trying to sort this out right now. There's a big change being proposed by the governor's office. The foundation that I'm the chairman of has real concerns about it, because as you make the good faith effort to move to this a new accountability system, you could blow up the old one and not get to the new one.
Right.
And then, you know, there'll be a lot of cheering for the people that don't want to hold anybody to account.
Right.
So I don't have the clear answer to this, but the fact that people are thinking about it gives me some hope that we could figure out how to get there.
Well, I do want you to know I'm thinking about it a lot. It's clearly an information management problem, right? It's how do you get the right information to the right people at the right time to help them make better decisions? Part of my thinking is it moves somewhat from the supply side to the demand side. In other words, imagine a world where every child has a customized learning plan, and you're basically holding everybody accountable for how well that child is progressing on that plan. And so you're collecting data on how that child is doing, whether that child's in a tutoring program in a boys and girls club, or a child is, you know, in a traditional charter school or neighborhood school, whatever. You're assimilating all that data to track each individual child's progress. And you're sort of an accountability to make sure that every child is progressing on that plan.
Yeah. And then you have a backpack of information that follows the child. And the part that has been so missing in our accountability system, partially by design by the people that don't want to be held to account, is parents don't know.
Right.
I mean, it's for a lot of parents, their kids are past, you know, 90% of kids graduate from high school with a degree, you know, our graduation rate is 90% now. 1998, it was 50%.
Right.
So you would think, oh my God, I mean, we're just marching bands celebrating this great success. But then you ask, among those graduates, how many can take college level work?
Right.
And that number drops dramatically.
Right.
And so parents, when they're told, you know, your kids, you know, ninth grade and goes to 10th, but they're a seventh grade level reader, it comes as a shock because it's the first time they've heard about this. Right. So I think in your world that you're describing, you would want to have parents be given that that tool of information. And any test that we have ought to be totally diagnostic as well, where the information is taken at the end of the year. The test is to measure where you stand. Parents get that information with tips on what a child could do in the summertime to catch up, or if they have strengths, how you accelerate those strengths. And now with artificial intelligence, that information could be in plain spoken English given to parents. The teacher that taught the student ought to be given that information as well to so that he or she can learn how to be a better teacher for the next group of students. And next year's teacher, if you know who it is, ought to be given that information so that atrophy doesn't set in. So I think you're onto something in a customized demand-driven system where parents and students are in front and center, and they're given these array of options. The key to make this work is real accountability and real information that parents would have.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'm struggling with, it's like a therapy session for me, I apologize, but it's helpful for me, is, you know, there's in psychology, there's, I forget the exact term it's called, something like choice overload or something like that. But I read some of the research which suggests if you give somebody 35 choices, they actually make worse choices than if you give them six, because you get overwhelmed with the information and you just sort of shut down. It's just, it's too much to process. Well, in the world of ESAs, particularly in an online environment where we're in, you sort of have a universal course catalog. I mean, there's so many stuff out there that you can pick from. How's a parent going to navigate all that? And so I'm worried about this sort of choice dilemma that the psychologists talk a lot about. So I'm grappling with, do we provide recommendations? So, you know, when I watch a movie on Netflix, I get right after I'm done, they say, okay, you like this movie, you're probably going to like this movie and this movie. Or Yelp, you know, if you're looking for this kind of restaurant, you go on Yelp and you find recommendations. So I'm wondering, how would you navigate that in terms of giving parents feedback about helping them make better choices, but doing it in a way that's appropriate?
Well, first of all, I think we need to make sure that parents aren't given one choice. For starters, there still are, you know, places where parents are given one choice. So let's work on that first. And then if you have 30 choices, which I don't know if we'd have 30 choices, variations of fewer choices perhaps gets to 30. I don't think it's wrong to ask parents what are their interests are, what do they think their kid needs, and guide them to six choices or five or four choices. I don't think that's wrong at all. You're not shutting down other options. You're giving them a path forward. Now, they can go back and say, no, I want to go back to having these three options be a combination of these three things be the ones that matter. But it's a far better world than the world that we came from, where we had a 50% graduation rate. We had an eighth grade level graduation test to require, you know, graduating from high school. And where no one cared. I mean, literally, I mean, the good-hearted nature of teachers was certainly there, but the system itself was not based on, continual improvement. There were societal problems that basically excused away why we had such a crappy system. So these are, you know, high-class problems that you wake up in the middle of the night with, Doug. These are problems of abundance of choices. My gosh, I hope we, you know, if that's our biggest problem, then I think we're onto something. I would add that this stuff has to start far earlier. You know, the gaps in learning, irrespective of whether you're in a private school or a charter school or a public school, grow pretty quick if you can't read by the end of third grade. Yeah. And, you know, we need really robust pre-K literacy-based learning. I mean, it can't just be childcare. It has to be important. And then we need to know, parents need to know, what are the deficiencies, and kindergarten teachers do as well. We can't wait to third grade and say we're going to end social promotion. There needs to be a real focus on pre-K to three. I think we need to mobilize groups. You brought up the Boys and Girls Clubs. I mean, there's lots of different organizations that could be part of this. It should be a national calling. If, you know, we'll lead the way in Florida, hopefully. It should be a high priority. I know Chris Sprouse is focused on reading a massive amount of books going to families that don't have books. I mean, these are great ideas, but there should be an overlying strategy irrespective of where a student is going, whether it's a public or private or charter, that's focused on ending third grade, being able to read so that they can acquire knowledge starting in fourth.
Yeah. I want to ask you another issue that I've been thinking a lot about and see what your take on it is. As we talk today, February 1st, 2022, there are almost 45,000 students who have a means-tested scholarship who are not using that scholarship. So I've got about 155,000 kids on scholarship, but I've got another 45,000 who have an award but can't find a right placement. So there's sort of a supply challenge with the growth that we're having. I also know that there's a lot of district schools that have a lot of open space.
Yes.
And you know, the biggest challenge you have in opening up a private school is certainly the physical infrastructure, the capital cost. And as you know, there's no money available for that. So I'm wondering, do you see a future where the infrastructure in the district schools is made available to other entrepreneurs who come in and say, you know, you got empty space here in place, you know, place like New York, as you know, where they share space. I mean, Eva Moskowitz is battling to get space for her. Is something like that possible in Florida? Because there's so much infrastructure out there. It seems to me that if we could do a better job of making the empty space available for educational entrepreneurs, we might be able to deal with some of the supply issue more effectively and efficiently.
Yeah, no, it's definitely there's an opportunity. It won't happen because superintendents of school and school boards will openly embrace this for whatever reason. I'm not sure. I've never understood why a dynamic superintendent wouldn't say, look, my job is to make sure that the students in my district have a fighting chance to live a life of purpose and meaning, irrespective of where they go to school.
Right.
I'm superintendent of all schools, whether I'm directly involved in private schools, I want to assist them as well. That, I mean, if that mindset became the norm, you would have so much innovation.
Yeah.
And the friction that exists for these entrepreneurs, typically under-resourced, that struggle mightily to be successful, you would see all sorts of options, and superintendents would become heroes. I mean, they'd be national heroes if any big urban school district, or even all of our districts are bigger than their peers around the country. You could make a mark by doing that. And so, for sure, taking buildings that are not fully occupied, which is obviously an issue as public student populations are in decline. You would have great opportunities to do that. I also think legislature and the governor haven't embrace this. I would have hoped that they would, but with the amount of money that Washington is giving states, I mean, like obscene amounts of money. I mean, there's no way to spend it.
I know.
That kind of environment. And Governor DeSantis has made proposals. The legislature is doing work, not in what I'm going to suggest, but in other areas where they're taking one-time money to invest in long-term things. That's the way to go. But why not have a one-time fund to be able to provide for private school capacity along with charter schools as well in places where districts don't want to give up space? I mean, I think it's both. I think it's providing capital for the expansion of new capacity and then using the excess capacity in the public schools to be able to deal with the potential growth. One will require a mindset change. The others are going to require one-time monies, both of which are here. If you really, you got to encourage the first and provide the dough for the second.
Yeah. The other thing I think will also help is when all the scholarship programs are ESAs, because that then opens up for micro schools, all kinds of, you know, innovative opportunities that right now, none of the means tested programs are ESAs. But once that happens, that also will help us out in terms of a supply side, because it's easier to open up a micro school. You don't have to have the kind of brick and mortar investments. But we really can't do that now because the only ESA is the Unique Ability Special Needs Program. So I think that's also going to help. That'll allow entrepreneurs to come in. I got to tell you, Governor, there's a small army of entrepreneurs knocking on my door saying, as soon as there's ESAs across the board in Florida, we're coming in with all kinds of amazing, interesting things. So I think that's going to help also.
I honestly believe we're on the precipice of that. Probably not this year, but it's not that far off. It could happen pretty soon. Yeah. Where we moved, you know, we take the West Virginia model, but which is fully ESAs, but with already an infrastructure of private and hybrid kind of schools available for parents. West Virginia's got like has gone from, you know, zero to 100 miles an hour in 3 seconds, but they don't have the capacity to meet any potential demand that when they roll this out next year, because they, you know, they just don't have the private school infrastructure. We now have it in a lot of places, and it could grow pretty quick. Back to the one-time monies, I mean, some governors and states have appropriated some of the stimulus money for building pods to kind of stimulate the growth. Yeah. And then once it becomes, there's demand for it in an ESA environment, you would have that be funded, right?
Right. Yeah. Last thing, and then I'm going to let you go. You're very generous with your time. Erica Donalds, a champion, as you know, of Ed Choice in Florida, is launching a new charter school that is pretty interesting. I wanted to get your take on it. Part of the day, every day, kids will be involved in virtual reality that allows them to, for example, work with a biologist in a volcano in Central America to look at the biology there, or work in a physics lab or whatever. I mean, through virtual reality, you can put yourself any place. Do you see that as a big part of the future, where kids can, affluent families can always, you know, take their kids all kinds of places that low-income families can't? I know in St. Pete, when I taught in inner-city school, we were 3 miles from the beach, and I had kids who were 16, 17, never been to the beach in St. Pete. And so a lot of low-income communities, the kids just don't have the access to kinds of things. And I'm wondering if virtual reality begins to create some equality of opportunity, because it lowers the cost of you going places. So I'm curious how you think about that and how that might play out moving forward.
So I got a little tour of the school that's being built, Erica's building, and it's wild. I mean, it's like, oh, this is like amazing. And you've got to believe that the technology is going to improve exponentially going forward, with every major technology company saying the future is in the metaverse.
Right.
So I think it does offer not just a quality of opportunity as you describe it, but also you hinted at, and you not just hinted, you basically shared a vision of a hybrid form of learning, you know, where choices aren't just one thing and you get to pick one. You have five different options and you can only pick one. It could be that you pick
all of the above.
Right. Metaverse is definitely going to be part of that. And you could imagine really high quality content turning on young people that otherwise wouldn't have access to that. And she's on the cutting edge of that. Interestingly, the demand for her school is extraordinary. And there's a waiting list. And you would think that, you know, like people would go, well, maybe it's because of the pandemic. Maybe people said, I don't want to send my kid back to school. But I think there's more to this. There's a lot of interest in innovation. And frankly, ultimately, the best and longest, most sustained changes that will take place in education policy won't be because Doug and Jeb think it's really cool. It's because parents demand it.
Right.
And this, I think, will be one of those means of learning that will become demanded by students who are totally embraced the metaverse. I mean, if Right. Maybe too much. They got to get off their video games. But it's, you know, they're digital natives already in many cases. And so, you know, I do anticipate this becoming part of the educational experience going forward. And again, I love my state. I want Florida to be a leader across the board, constantly, always innovating, always trying to, you know, I want to use an old, you might appreciate this, your son wouldn't, but I want Florida to be the Mikey in the Ovaltine commercial.
I remember that.
He's the younger kid that is trying the Ovaltine, where the kid, you know, the older brother always says, let Mikey try it. We should always be the ones trying new things and learning from them to make them better.
Right. No, I agree. My family goes back to the early 1890s in St. Pete. So I have deep roots in Florida, and I agree with you. I take a lot of pride in StepUp being, you know, a national leader in ed choice. And I take a lot of pride in Florida too. And Governor, we would not be here without you. Lots of other people I appreciate, but your leadership has been extraordinary, and you have inspired a lot of us in ways that you don't appreciate. And I just, on behalf of over a million families and all kinds of educators, I just want to say thank you.
You bet, Doug. It was a joy to be governor. I've had a blast doing it. And the part I enjoyed the most was working along with some really, really dedicated, committed Floridians to transform our education system, give people more chances.